This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about crime as a factor in mental health, specifically how being a victim of it can contribute to the development of certain conditions or your mental health deteriorating more generally. There is also a clear link in the other direction as well, with MIND identifying that those with mental health problems are 3 times as likely to be a victim of crime than the general population. So not only is this a really important theme for us to cover, one that I feel is long overdue, it's also one that's extra important because of that dangerous cycle. That if you are a victim of crime, related or unrelated to your mental health, you are also more likely to be a repeat victim.
Yeah, and I think it's such an interesting topic, and I think one that's not necessarily covered so much when we talk about mental illness, the impacts of crime. I was really pleased that we decided to do this episode.
Yeah, and one of the reasons that sparked it was the guest sent us a brilliant pitch email and really highlighted something I'd been thinking about for a while, which is the responsibilities of podcasters in terms of the true crime genre. It's a category of podcasting that's really exploded over the last few years. And yet the mental health impact is rarely talked about. And in fact, certain shows can be quite disrespectful of the subject matter. And that's certainly what the guest was highlighting to me as well, that there are a lot of true crime podcasts nowadays that have quite a funny or satirical angle at telling these stories of very serious crimes that have happened to real people. And even with how thorough a lot of these shows can be, there are important parts of the story that seem to be missed. And so I just wanted to read a bit of information that Jan Canty, our guest for today, sent across. She is a psychologist, author, and fellow podcast host who has a specialist interest in this exact area. So I'll just read an extract of what she sent us. The stigma of grief following a murder is overlooked not only on podcasts, but in movies, scholarly research, and books. The focus has been on the perpetrator. For example, many of your listeners are undoubtedly familiar with murderer Harold Shipman, but how many people know the names of the next of kin of his elderly victims, Angela Wagstaff, Anthony Nuttall, and others, and what they went through? And so that's really at the core of what we're talking about today, broadening out this conversation and looking at the impact crime has on those that are close to it, but also the huge impact it can have on whole communities.
Well, what's very interesting about that is that I actually know Harold Shipman's sister.
What?
I know.
Well, you have to tell me about that now.
Yeah, so I know her very well. And it's just come to me now hearing you say that about the fact that we really didn't know how to speak to her and deal with it, really. It was a real kind of weird thing. And it actually just hit me now hearing you read that. Yeah, I grew up with her.
Wow.
I say grew up with her, but she was in the circles that I was in, the world of sport. So, yeah, it was really difficult and there was a real stigma attached how we supported her. I mean, I was young at the time, so it wouldn't have been for me to support her, but the adults around me that knew her well, there was a lot of whispering and a lot of, gossip, I guess. And I think it's interesting because our guest talks about that, doesn't she? The impact of media when it comes to murder or things that are a lot more high profile, then the impact of everybody around you, and journalists wanting to speak to you and all that kind of stuff, really more to find out about the perpetrator than really caring about how you and your family are doing.
Absolutely. And in many ways, his sister, as you described there, was probably just really keen to put it behind her and try and distance herself from it. You know, how do you wrap your head around something like that? So to then suddenly have all this media attention, you know, there's trauma on that side, there's trauma with the families of the victims as well. And a lot of it comes back to us not knowing how to have certain conversations. We did an episode on grief not long ago. Even grief when it comes to situations that are expected, where it's someone that's elderly and that we knew they had health problems, there's still this inability to have the conversation. And that can even lead to people just not even asking how you're doing because they're scared of you answering and them being inequipped to continue the conversation. This is the extreme version. And Jan very much shares that in the episode as well, how people just had no idea what to say to her. They wanted to support her, but they didn't know how to. And that uncomfortability they were feeling meant that she got kind of pushed away and shunned, even if that wasn't actually anyone's intention.
Absolutely.
And then she also sent us over some information that was really interesting in terms of the UK and the US.
Yeah, so the macro trends of homicide peaked in the UK in 2002, but rose again in 2014. And in the US, homicides doubled from 1960 to the late 1970s. They fell in 1984, peaked again in 1991, and then declined sharply every year until this year, 2020. More to the point, for every murder, there are 8 to 10 people who are deeply and immediately impacted by that homicide. This translates to a staggering number of homicide survivors worldwide who feel bereft. And I think that is so important and something that Jan brings to us, in that it is not just the person that's directly impacted by crime, but the ripple effect it has on family members and colleagues and people that you go to school with or work or whatever. It has such a massive effect on those around. And there's just there may be support for people if they really go and seek support from, you know, going down the conventional, go to your GP, say that you need counselling, wait for 6 months to be on a list, or you've got the money to pay for therapists yourself. But actually, there's just not that immediate, right, we are here, we will help you and for as long as you need, and offering that support and even recognising it, really.
100%. And none of this is to scare people. You know, luckily we do live in a country where murder is still very rare. But instead, what we are saying is, when you look at crime of all different kinds, really, the number of people that are impacted is so much broader. And so that's the thing. So not necessarily needing to change your daily life because of stats like this, but we could all do better at having conversations around this, because I struggle to think of it being possible that anybody in this country doesn't know someone that's been a victim of crime. Of course, for the most part, that won't be an experience like Jan went through with her husband. But all of us probably know someone that's been involved in a vehicle-related crime or has been burgled.
And, you know, I will point out that there are certain demographics who do see and live around violence a lot more than others. And those groups aren't necessarily either overly supported. And we see a lot of retaliation and a lot of anger. And it really does have a rippling effect. You're right, there are varied crimes that can happen. But as Jan's talking about, you know, murder and homicide, you know, we've seen numbers rise with young males between 16 and 24 in the last few years, disproportionately with other demographical groups and the communities that are affected, especially within my community. And my partner was talking to me the other day. He has grown up and been to funerals of more friends before he was 30 than what people outside of potentially that demographic or community would ever imagine. And the trauma that comes with that, that is buried and not discussed, for parents, for sisters, for boyfriends, for girlfriends, for children, is overwhelming. And so it's an area that's very close to my heart, actually.
Yeah. And it's something that, again, has that real mental health link. For example, Fiske, one of our first ever guests, a lot of the issues he's had to deal with in terms of his mental health was from losing so many people close to him from a young age. And many of those people lost their lives to mental health related circumstances. And it is difficult to wrap your head around. The weight that this can leave in someone's life still needs so much more research and understanding. You know, an easy example is when someone has a burglary, it can so undermine their feeling of safety in that home that they may never feel safe again in it. And yet there is yet to be that immediate support you described.
I came home, Bobby, last winter to seeing a guy jumping off my garage. I was with my children in the car. It's 4:30 p.m. but it's black outside, dead of winter, and the guy's jumping out off the garage out of my bathroom window. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what the hell? So I've got to get back in the car, as I was about to get the kids out of the car so they didn't see, hide my fear so they didn't see, drive them to my mum's, get them out of the car whilst telling her she can see that I'm scared, go to the police station, come back to the house with the police, come in the house, with the police, go through it all, see fingerprints, and that my house had been ransacked. You know, I didn't stay at home that night, but I did the night after, and it was awful. And this winter, I'm really worried about it again. And so I leave my lights on all the time, you know, and the effect of that, you know, you've got your lights on all the time and your electric bill and all the rest of it that you worry about. But, you know, on a real, like, I'm nervous about winter comes, like, oh, here we go again. Like, when I come in from school, I've got to kind of check the house before I let the kids out. It has a massive effect on me.
Yeah, and I didn't even know any of that. But then that's part of the problem, right? It's just not talked about. So hopefully, in our own way, with this episode, we're getting a lot of conversations like this going. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Jan is just so intellectual on this topic. And so I think we covered it in a really broad way. So we'll get into that episode in a moment. But first,
who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hello, my name is Jan Canty, and I'm here to discuss stigma as it relates to mental health. My very early awakening of the whole concept of mental illness was when I was around 6 years of age. And at that time in my life, we had our dry cleaning picked up and dropped off by a woman who came to our front door because we didn't have but one car that my dad took to work. And one day she didn't come on her appointed time, and I asked my mom where she was, and she had told me suicide. And I didn't know what that word meant, and I asked her to explain it, and she told me what it meant. And that was inconceivable to me, that someone would purposely hurt themselves. And she explained about depression and that sometimes there are burdens that people carry that you can't tell by watching them. They're smiling and they're polite, but inside they're really unhappy. And that was the first time I kind of was aware that there's this whole other issue out there that you don't always confront, but that it exists and it can touch you at any time.
And it sounds like overall your mom was able to really well articulate that for you and explain from a young age, this is the reality of what some people go through. Did you find that came out in other ways through your childhood?
Yeah, she was a very compassionate person. She loved people. She was also, looking back, I didn't have a name for this, but looking back, she also had great boundaries. If people had told her something in confidence, she would never disclose it. So she had a compassion for people, and my father had a real interest in science. So between the two of them, I got a nice complimentary look at people. I could talk about the brain with him. I could talk about neurology with him. And my mom would talk about the impact that all that has on individuals. So it was like the way I think of it is like a natural breeding ground for me to eventually become a psychologist. I credit that with them.
Yeah, no, that's really great. And in many ways, I think that's a profession that is quite a good blend of the two, the scientific elements and also the social and human angle.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, did you find that mental health was an issue for you or relating to your family?
My next experience was pretty dramatic. I was about 11 years of age, and my mom's mom had been married 5 times. She was not a happy individual. She divorced them all. One day, it was accompanying my mom to see my grandmother, who I was never close with, never particularly liked. And we walked up the stairs to her apartment, and it was always really in perfect condition. And I walked in the other room for a minute, and all of a sudden, I heard this shouting starting, which was extremely uncharacteristic of my mom. She was very jovial most of the time. And I went into the kitchen, and it's even hard to describe it. My mom was like pinned in a corner, and my grandmother was shaming her and threatening her over what I don't remember. But I just remember being furious. And I somehow knew that my grandmother would never hurt me. And I was bound and determined she was not going to hurt my mother. And I literally got between them and I shamed my grandmother. I said, "You get back. You don't ever talk to my mother that way. What is wrong with you?" And my mom kept saying, "Get out of here. Get out." And I go, "No, I will not leave you here. She's crazy. No." And so then after that, my mom explained to me how abusive my grandmother had been. For all her years, she was the oldest of 6 children. And I think my mom became a great mom because she did the opposite of everything her mother did. It made me very protective of my mom. It made me tune into domestic violence. And I was just flabbergasted. I had never seen an argument like that. And that was a real awakening as well.
Yeah, for sure. And it sounds like there could be a clear link there with how your mom approached mental health and boundaries, given what she'd experienced. Mm-hmm.
Right. And then about 6 months after that, it was a real snowy evening. And we were all home alone watching. Our family was home by itself watching TV. And the phone rang, which was not common at night. But I ran and got the telephone. And it sounded like my uncle was, I couldn't put a finger on it. He was laughing or crying or distraught or something. But he wasn't himself. And I just said to my dad, you know, you better take this phone call. And so he came on the line. And it turned out that he had been drinking and driving and gotten an accident. And my aunt had been killed. And that was another big upheaval because that was my mom's closest sibling. Mm. And they blamed him for that, which I guess in some ways makes sense. But we never saw them again after that. I was never allowed to see my cousins or anything.
Wow.
On that side of the family. They were furious with him.
And do you feel that took a toll on you as a young person?
I think the biggest impact it had on me was never to drink and drive, really. And I missed my aunt a great deal. She was a very funny, outgoing, loving person. She loved to pull pranks, and I missed that. Like, I remember one morning I stayed the night at her house, and then in the morning she put a rubber egg on my plate and tried to watch me cut it, and I couldn't. And she just started laughing. I mean, she would do silly stuff like that, and I missed her. And I also was upset that it had the toll on my mom that it did. And by that time, I knew a little bit more about my mom's background, so I thought, you know, she suffered enough without this, her closest sibling dying too violently. So it was kind of compacted, all of those events, in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah. And throughout this, would you say there was an initial interest in psychology and how people tick starting to bloom?
That came a little later. I went to college and I was reading a book called The Magic Years by Selma Freiberg. My original goal was to write a children's book. I wanted to major in English and write books. But I read this book in order to better understand children, but it was written by a child psychoanalyst. And I was so taken with her insights that I decided to double major in psychology and English. And that's how eventually I got into that.
Yeah, which foreshadows at some point us talking about your book and what a good combo those degrees are for what you're involved in now. And so would you mind sharing with us the experience that fundamentally changed mental health for you?
Sure. I would say for the most part, my life was pretty even. And I was happy and confident and felt very sure of my future. But then on July the 14th, 1985, my husband did not come home, which was not like him. It was very unlike him. And it was a very raging storm that night, too. And I stayed up all night waiting for him, trying to make phone calls, trying to figure out what was going on. And in the morning, when he did not come home, I went to his office. This is before cell phones, of course. And try to figure out where he was and if it was storm related. That was my first thought. He got bogged down in a storm someplace. To make a long, complicated story short, within a week, I found out that he had been missing and murdered and buried 250 miles northwest of where I lived by two people from the inner city. It was complicated, but he had befriended these two individuals in the Cass Corridor area of Detroit. And had been supporting their pretty awful lifestyle with cash, cars, rent, groceries. I did not know that we were broke. And so when the police commissioner told me what happened and that he had forged this secret identity even for 18 months and that we were probably penniless, almost within the next breath, he said, and you have to go to the morgue to help identify him. And we've unearthed him. He's been buried for a week in the University of Michigan Biologic Station in a bog. They flew the remains back to the Wayne County Morgue, and I was fortunate enough to have been accompanied by Detective Marlis Landeros. She was the first woman of color to enter the Detroit police force and be promoted. I mean, she was, I can't, that's a whole nother show how I feel about that woman. She was just remarkable. Anyway, she literally accompanied me right up to and including the full identification. And she protected me as best she could from the media fallout. And she literally accompanied me to court, none of which she had to do. That was above and beyond her job. But there were no victims advocates in those days. And I was running on empty. I hadn't slept in a long, long time, soundly at least. And I fell in and I experienced what I now know is acute stress disorder, which gave way to PTSD. And then depression set in. And it kept getting reinforced by the media. Then there was the preliminary hearing, Then there was the trial.
So one thing I just want to pause with there is the way you've described it and so many horrible things that happened to you in such a short space of time. Am I right in imagining, at least in the early stages when he went missing and you had no idea what had happened, that that time felt like it was going incredibly slowly?
Yes, very, very true. It time was not in 24-hour segments. It was like one long day. And by the time my parents flew in to help me, which was about 3 days later, I had been awake pretty much that whole time, short of cat naps. I hadn't eaten, hadn't showered, and it hadn't even occurred to me to do either. It was like one long day. Time had little meaning to me, really.
Yeah, and that's very common from my understanding when you're in that state of shock, that your natural instinct is to just kind of stay ready and stay in this frozen, like fight or flight state. And right. So suddenly all the secondary things like changing your clothes and going for a shower and all the things that normally sort of bookmark our days become very irrelevant when you're feeling so at threat.
Right. That's true. And I didn't know if it was better to leave the house or stay there in case he showed up. There was 1,001 questions on my mind, and I think I was running on adrenaline and caffeine, and that combined with little sleep, you really feel physically sick, too. It's not a pleasant place to be at all. And the media by that time was descending and very intrusive, very disrespectful. Clearly, they were in it for their own needs.
And may I ask, was there a particular point, was it when they found him that the media really kicked in, or was there attention even before that?
It was before that, and I think it's because it was such an unusual situation. Here you have a man from the suburbs who's living this nice life, who's in this strange relationship with this pimp and his prostitute downtown, and giving away money, and then he comes up missing. And I think had all of the salacious details that the public tends to gravitate towards. So even before that, as soon as his car was found and it was burned up, that's when the media really got involved.
Yeah. In terms of those initial days, then when you first had to identify his body and around the same time as starting to find out sides of his life that were up to that point hidden from you, what was your kind of focus and to what degree were you able to even take any of that in?
You're right about that. I wasn't able to take it in. In fact, for a long, long time, I kept thinking, they got it wrong. Mm. This can't be. This isn't who he is. He's not that way. And it was just like I stepped into somebody else's life. Like I'm just humming along and all of a sudden I slipped through Alice in Wonderland and here I'm in this weird place where nothing makes sense. And I think in retrospect, that was why Detective Landeros wanted me to go to the morgue to reinforce, no, this is true. It did happen, as part of a way to bring me back to reality and show me that they were not bluffing. I mean, they showed me photos of the evidence, which was horrific. They didn't tell me a lot. They told me the facts of the case, but there was a lot they didn't tell me. And I think it's because they were so busy. I mean, Detroit at that time, that one city, had over 800 murders, and they were busy solving the next one. When mine was on the front burner, it wasn't there long, and pushed it off to the prosecuting attorney's office, and they were on to the next case. So they didn't sit me down and handhold me by any stretch of the imagination. They didn't have time to. So there was a lot of questions that I didn't know the answer to.
Yeah, and I imagine that could really reinforce the symptoms of PTSD that were coming through when you're still trying to wrap your head around it, and it no doubt would have felt still incredibly surreal, and then you find yourself being questioned about this.
Right, and then I think the question that bothered me the most, still does, is if people say, how could you not know? How could you not know? I don't like being asked that question. It's like, it feels judgmental. It feels like the implication is I would have known.
But also it's putting the blame on you. That actually, of course you didn't know if you look at it another way, because your husband was hiding this from you. You know, he was doing that successfully and that's why you didn't know. And so really the question is for him, but of course it is the people that are left behind that everyone expects these perfect answers from. And I think even in situations where people die in ways that we feel are quite straightforward, like they die of old age and they maybe go to peace around family. It's the same thing. There's always these questions about who was this person? What did they mean? How did they impact us? And everyone has their different version of who a person is. So in what you were going through, I don't really see that you were ever going to be able to answer these kind of questions.
And I think when people ask that question, I think part of it is to reassure themselves that they would have known and that they would somehow be safe from this. And I'm here to tell you, it's possible. There are a lot of things in marriage you don't always know. And if somebody is determined and good at it, you're not going to know them. You're not going to figure it out until it's too late.
Yeah.
Would I have done things differently in hindsight? Yeah, but that's with hindsight. Like I would have requested to see our bank statements. I had no need to see them because he handled the money. And I was busy during getting my PhD. I'd rather not have to deal with something like that. So that always really did bother me a lot when people would ask me that.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And it's one of those uncomfortable truths, right, that many people don't want to face, that in many ways, your romantic partner is the person that could be the most invested in lying to you. You know, they right. are someone that is so involved in your life and you matter so much to each other that they could easily start a chain of lying if they saw that. Even with the intention of supporting the relationship, people lie and omit because they think it's better for a marriage.
And love is blind for some of us. You tend to believe, you tend to have faith. In retrospect, I now know many years later that this was a pattern of him his whole life. I did not know that. Even though we've been married 10 years before he was killed, I had no idea that this was his go-to. He always had to have something kind of mystery on the side, which I didn't know. And I was so busy commuting to Ann Arbor and getting my doctorate and then my postdoc, I wasn't even home that much. So that made it convenient in retrospect. I see that.
And what do you think, as best as you can in hindsight, that was for? You know, was that serving a particular purpose, having this kind of double life?
Yes, I think in his case, I'm fairly convinced after talking with high school friends of his and other pieces of information, plus my own recollections, I think that the unconscious motivation behind all of this for him was he absolutely needed to be admired. He needed to be looked up to. He needed to be the expert. And that worked for us. We were 18 years apart in age. So when I initially met him, I was a high school graduate. And so that worked. I did look up to him and I did think he had the last word in psychology and what he was able to do. But as one person said to me, you outgrew him. You studied his field. And I know at the end, it really upset him when I would start questioning his outdated information. I'd say, what about neuroplasticity? That doesn't fit with what you just told me. And he would walk away. He did not want to hear that. So I think that was the tectonic plates that kind of cracked and pulled us apart at that point.
Yeah, no, that's really
And he went in search of another audience and he found one.
No, I can really see that. And do you feel like, particularly with the financial element, there may be an element of a rescue complex in his personality?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Because what I've learned now by looking at his history was that all of the women in his life were educationally not on his par and all were struggling financially and all had brown hair parted in the middle.
Wow. That's very specific. And what do you think he was attempting to appease? You know, because often when I come across rescue complexes, it's where someone is trying to kind of fill a gap, potentially via another person. So for me, it was something I had to work on with my experience of an eating disorder and my experience of depression, where sometimes I'd come across people with similar experiences that needed a bit of the kind of parenting that I missed parts of. And, you know, I would try and sort of fill that role. And really, that wasn't about them. It was about me and sort of what I was missing. And then since getting more mental health support, that's now something I don't feel a kind of yearning to get to in that way. Do you feel like there was a particular thing for him he was trying to fill?
I would describe his parents as having a very controlling, autocratic parenting style. And his love for them was unconditional, but their love for him was conditional. And it was conditioned upon him being a good son, on excelling, But at the same time, they kept undermining and criticizing him. So I think he grew up feeling like a phony because he was just one step away from being found to have something wrong with him, being another critical issue come up. And so he kept trying to appease them and please them. But I think it was all a shell. I think it was just external that there was, I don't think internally he really felt authentic and the successful person that he was.
Yeah.
And so he needed to be reaffirmed to that time and time again by surrounding himself with people that would look up to him, that needed him financially, yeah. if only other ways.
No, of course. And I think financially, it's a quite clear way of externalizing that. If you've not solved it internally, then you can win over a lot of authority with financial or academic esteem.
Right.
And so what was that experience like in terms of symptoms of mental ill health coming up around that time?
One huge one was insomnia, indigestion, weight loss. I was irritable. I had trouble focusing, which was very different for me. I could focus for hours and hours. Very fatigued easily, wanting to withdraw from people except my parents. And needing some kind of structure again. I felt like everything was topsy-turvy and I needed some kind of routine in my life again. But that was disrupted by the media because they would show up at my office as well as my house. And I'd have to deal with them. Everywhere I turned, they were there. Mm-hmm. And bills kept coming. There were so many fires to put out that all were important, that there was no time for reflection. There was no time to check things off a list and say, that's done, because I'm trying to get out of this house I can't afford. It was huge. I never wanted it. It was huge. I didn't need this big house. So I'm having to put up with people coming through it. I had to keep it in perfect condition. I had no money because he'd given it all away. And so I was worried I was going to be homeless, even though I was living in this 6-bedroom house. It was bizarre. And it was just a time of survival. It was a time of uncertainty, but determination. I never, ever questioned I would get through it. I always questioned how I would do it, but I never questioned I would. That was always in the back of my mind. I just didn't know how, and I didn't know anybody to talk to who'd been through what I'd been through. And even today, there are a few resources for so-called homicide survivors.
Right. You know, it's so great that you had that sense of strength in yourself, that ability to get through it, because this really extended your trauma. That when we talk about PTSD, so often we talk about you having a physical and mental response to things you've been through, whereas in this situation, you were still going through so much of that trauma because of all these fires you describe.
Mm-hmm. I think I credit my brother, my older brother, too, to some of my determination, because he was kind of bossy and I would never kowtow to him. He'd throw his shirt at me and say, go iron this, and I'd step on it. Or he'd say, I'm going to hold you in a wrestling move until you can't get out of it. And I would just egg him on like, you're not going to hurt me. You can't hurt me. And he just made me really, I don't think it was his intention, but he made me very determined to protect myself and to be able to have self-confidence, because I wasn't going to let him boss me around. And it was also the time of the women's movement in the United States. And that helped me to realize that there are other strong women out there who've met other obstacles. So, and my parents, of course, too, they were great. And I credit them a lot with my can-do attitude, which has served me well in my life. It has in other areas too.
Yeah, no, and no doubt they would have been such an asset, and their level of understanding, particularly in this time.
Mm-hmm.
And then with your background, were you qualified at that point? What level were you at with your career?
I was just finishing my postdoctoral fellowship and opening my practice. We had just relocated. I mean, we hadn't even unpacked the boxes yet. We just relocated to our joint practice when he was killed. So I was legally and professionally ready to open a practice, but I didn't have any patients except for a few, and I was intending on growing it, of course. And this happened. So I was at that awkward point where, yeah, I had the education, but I didn't have an income.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't get it from the house sale because the house wouldn't sell. In Michigan, there was a law in the books, which is still there, which is if some gruesome event has happened to an owner of the house, you have to disclose that to a buyer. If you don't, because if they're superstitious, they may want to back out. And if you don't disclose it to them, they can rescind the deal at any point. So that devalued the house by about 25%.
Wow, I can certainly see that. And with your academic background, were you able to see the kind of symptoms that were coming up for you, or did that come later?
Yes, it did. I wasn't, for example, scared at all by the nightmares. I knew, okay, that's about par where I should be right about now. And I knew enough to know I needed a physical, and I knew enough to know I needed to eat even though I wasn't hungry. I knew my irritability was related to the depression and the fatigue. So in some ways, it was a benefit. I would say one of the drawbacks was, I think people expected more of me than I could deliver. They'd, you know, say, well, you could handle this. You know, you're a psychologist. Well, when it's your husband, it doesn't matter, you know? And they would say things that I think were cruel at times, thinking, I thought their joke was funny and it wasn't. And so I think it was a double-edged sword.
Yeah, I can see that. And do you feel like part of that issue was related to the stigma around murder, that for many people, they would be more comfortable to try and brush it away and have you just suddenly be back to normal rather than really acknowledge and talk about what happened?
Absolutely. 100%. I feel that way. The stigma of homicide survivors is conveyed through sentiments like, well, you're not over that yet. It's been 6 months. Or what do you mean you can't sleep? You're tired. You complain you're tired. And well, you know, you're not going to be given any more than you can handle. I mean, all these what I call bumper stickers, slogans are hurled at you, which right. is infuriating. And I think it's their wish to hurry you along so that they're not uncomfortable. You know, just be normal. Just at least act normal for my benefit instead of being genuine. And in my situation, the stigma, I think, was internal as well, because I developed what I now know. I didn't have a name for it then, but I now know is conflicted grief, where you have a sense of relief in the grief, as well as the traditional kind of grief. And that makes you feel rather guilty, that privately it's like, I'm glad he's gone. My God, look at what he did to he put my own life in danger, I found out, because they were following him home. I didn't know any of this till the police told me. He could have gotten us both killed. And he lied to me. He was unfaithful. He gave up our money. He put us both in danger. He put his mother in danger because he got money from her and gave it away. And do I want him back? No. Now, does that make me wish what happened to him happened to him? No. But it's not the normal kind of mourning and grief with a homicide, in the sense that it wasn't just like, oh my gosh, I wish he'd come back. I miss him so much and I just want to get back to how it was. No, I didn't feel that way. I felt there was a part of me that felt relieved, and that you don't acknowledge, you don't talk about that. That's taboo. We're not supposed to speak or think ill of the dead. So that stigma was internal as well as what was being tossed at me externally.
Yeah, I think it speaks to our inexperience in many ways dealing with grief, that although it's something that all of us have to deal with in our life, none of us are really adequately equipped for it. And so maybe it's like you describe, it's having a conflicted grief, but equally, oftentimes people can be angry as part of their grief stages. They're angry that the person is dead. And on the face of it, that doesn't make as much sense. But I think many people that have gone through grief of the people very closest to them, you've experienced the full gamut of emotions. And yeah. all of that is part of the process. And therefore, you have to make some kind of peace with going through that.
Mm-hmm. You do. And it helps, I think, to reduce that stigma and that conflicted grief if you have at least one person that you can be honest with and to say, you know, man, this is complicated. And if I could wind the clock back, I wouldn't have him back. And I feel bad saying that, but that's the truth of how I feel. But there wasn't anybody to share that with. But had I been able to, I think it would have helped.
Yeah. And I think one area you're very passionate about that's related to this is how we see these events portrayed through media and indeed through podcasting.
Oh yeah. Don't even get me started. Well, and I would add to that academia as well. I mean, academic research is just as blindsided by this as the pop media is. There's very little accuracy or attention given to homicide survivors. It's as the public is led to believe, and therefore does, that we somehow get closure after the trial or after the conviction. And that is so not true. Here's a case in point. I interviewed someone from my podcast whose little 2-year-old niece was murdered by the boyfriend of the mother. He got 20 years. He served 20 years. He's out. And he rented a house directly across the street from them and just sits on his front lawn with a chair staring at their house. like, okay, now what are you going to do to me? It never ends. I mean, and that's a pretty blatant example, but there is no closure with a homicide. You don't get over it. It's not like having a head cold. And because of PTSD, things will just suddenly pop back very vividly that is related to what happened years ago. Like, for example, it's a silly example, but it is true that I wanted pruning done on the edge of my property in a former house I owned. And I gave her the instructions of what I wanted and left for work and came back. And all that was left was the trunks of trees. It looked very open to me. And there was a jogging path on the other side. And I could not sleep. And I knew that it was related to the PTSD because you want boundaries, you want borders, you want a sense of control over your private life. And I knew that was taken from me. And I could not get a fence put in quick enough. And my husband was, who I remarried, and my husband was like, what's the deal with the fence? Why you just won't let this go? And I told him, and I don't know that he totally understood it, but he went along with it. But, you know, this is 30 years later, you know, and it still creeps in occasionally.
Yeah. And I think that goes for any event where we grow up thinking this will never happen. There's so many extreme things that people experience. And a way that we cope with these things existing is thinking it'll never happen to me. And so then if it does happen to you, then of course you start questioning everything else you think about your safety and your family and your life, really, your whole outlook.
Right. True. Because we're brought up to believe if I make good decisions and if I take reasonable precautions, I'll be okay. I mean, I spent my life with my nose in a book. Why would I think anything would have happened to me? I didn't hang out in rough places. I didn't join a gang. I didn't do anything risky. And yet here it is. It just crashed in, you know?
Yeah. And so as much as you'd come from that stable background, that doesn't insulate you necessarily.
You're absolutely right. But what it does do is give you tools to help you cope with it.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll always credit my family with that. They brought me up to have self-confidence and not to feel sorry for myself. And it was reinforced when I started traveling internationally to far-flung places. I've been to almost every continent and to do photography. And it reassured me that, boy, I think I got it bad. Here's these people that don't have clean water, that don't have any rights, that will never see a physician no matter what happens to them. And I'm complaining? It really put things in perspective for me. It still does.
Yeah. And when you look back at the decades that have passed since your husband's death, what do you find are the things that have helped you the most with your mental health?
The traveling did. Of course, time. I did not speak of it for 30 years. I moved away, didn't talk to anybody about it for 30 years. And then three events happened back to back that caused me to change course. And when I started talking about it, much to my surprise, people were very supportive. They were very interested and in a good way and encouraging. I didn't expect that. I just thought they would look at me as damaged or something and I wasn't going to have that, but they didn't. That helped me a great deal. I think also remarriage helped me because my husband's very able. He likes to cut grass and watch football. He's not into the drama that Al was into. It also helped that I had a mentor, and he helped me a great deal through the crisis times early on. And as I said before, Detective Landeros was very helpful. But I think overall, the biggest thing that helped me the most was connecting with other homicide survivors and realizing that all of our situations are unique, but we all have very similar responses to some of the things that have happened to us.
And I can see how reassuring that is. And I find that in a more general mental health perspective as well, that the more you come to understand other people's experiences, the more you find these parallels. And so it's no coincidence mm-hmm. that so many ways in which we're struggling to cope that is borne out via mental illness has these kind of shared symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Connection, I think, is key. Connecting with people that understand your situations from the inside out and realizing you're not alone is very beneficial.
For sure. And I think that's something that committing to these beliefs in the way that you did, not only that you would get through it, but you would find support and you would find understanding. I strongly believe once you've committed to that stuff in your mind, you then find ways to prove it. So if you're going around thinking, I'm not the only one, there are other people that can understand me, then you are more open to finding them and probably more active in that.
That's a really important point. I think that can't be said loud enough. I agree.
And then you mentioned podcasting briefly as well, which I know you are making great waves with. But even before we talk about that, I'm interested to hear what you think of podcasting in general, because I think podcasting is to an extent to blame for this mentality of closure, that with the focus so often being on the perpetrator of such crimes, there is then the idea of justice that comes through. And then if justice is then done, or if they find some other way to wrap up the episode, then we can easily fall into this way of thinking that the person goes to prison or they're caught or whatever the outcome is, and then that's closure. And of course, for the families, that's not the story at all. That is certainly not the end.
And that's especially true if they're found not guilty, or there's a mistrial, or endless delays, or corruption. I mean, there's lots of things that can go wrong. And I don't know how it is in the UK, but in the States, approximately 90, if I'm not mistaken, 93% of homicide cases never go to trial. They're resolved through a plea bargain. So there is no trial. There's just this behind closed deal that's made between the prosecutor office and the defendant office. And they're given a lesser offense to get rid of the case and get it off the desk and into the hands of the next case. There's another side to that. I think plea bargains have the advantage of saving homicide survivors from witnessing the evidence in court, which can be pretty hard to watch. And there is no uncertainty about if they're going to be found guilty or not, because they've already pled guilty in a plea bargain. But it does take away any public having to come to terms with what's taken place. I have mixed feelings about it.
Yeah, I can see that. And I totally understand. And so in terms of your work to try and put something more appropriate out into the world, what kind of issues are you looking to tackle in your own podcasting and indeed your book?
The one main point I'm trying to get across is the repercussions, the fallout, the long-term events that can happen as a result of a murder. It can go on more than one generation, the impact. Take my daughters as an example. I adopted them. Their biological mother was murdered, and then their father was incarcerated for an unrelated offense. He was not involved. So they were orphaned, and they were put into services, child protective services, and they languished, and I adopted them. And I can see the effects of that on them being in foster care for a long time. So here's a murder that happened when they were toddlers, and it's still affecting them. So it's the next generation. Well, podcasts and movies and books and research, they don't look at that. The story is nicely wrapped up. The focus is on the perpetrator, someone on the crime, someone on the victim of the crime. But that's the extent of the interest. And very little is known or being researched about the impact of homicide on the survivors, when in fact, about 9 people for every homicide are deeply and immediately impacted. That translates to thousands of people in every country every year that are wounded by what's happened, that are lost because there's not services for them, or they're not adequate, they're not understood. And so my podcast is trying to put a light on this and say, let's look at the repercussions of this cognitively, physically, legally, financially, emotionally, spiritually, and not just for family members. It could be first responders. It could be witnesses. It could be coworkers. There's any number of people that can be impacted. And every story is different, but it all needs to be attended to, and to drive home the point that the repercussions are wide.
For sure. I think that's so powerful. And it's something that I think someone who's affected by any crime can experience these issues. I'm talking to you from Birmingham in the UK, where only a few days ago we had a series of stabbings. And whilst it's very early days and not much is known, you can even tell with how people are moving around the city and how many people are checking with us about, are we okay? And the conversations I'm having with friends, there's this real feeling in the air of how it's affected everyone. I think so often that goes unnoticed in the very kind of pinpoint style of looking at the people most directly affected. And I'm not saying that they are to the same level. But what I'm saying is that we can't ignore this, because how can we ignore these things and then understand how mental health is affected in areas that are affected by war or cities that deal with terrorism, like in Manchester a few years ago? You know, there was huge mental health fallout, massive increases in referrals. And for many people, it was a factor, right? It wasn't as simple as this happened and people were affected, even if they were on the periphery of what happened, or they weren't even there, but they just know the venue or work nearby or somehow feel it's close to their heart. But in addition to what they no doubt already had going on,
there's a huge ripple effect to the public in general through publicized murders. You see that in how society has changed. Again, I'm speaking more from the United States, but after all these serial murderers that we had a rash of in the 70s and early 80s, you see that you don't see the hitchhikers you used to see. You don't see kids even be allowed to go and trick or treat by themselves or go down to the football or baseball stadium by themselves unaccompanied. There's just much more hovering being done by parents than there used to be. So it can have a ripple effect. And even though homicide is still a rare event, the fallout isn't. It's huge. And it does affect the public at large.
Yeah. And I think so much of the obvious answer, if you take the time to look into it, is mental health.
I noticed that one of the things that you're advocating for is public education in the area of mental health for little kids. And I think that's been overlooked way too long. Mm-hmm. We need to not only talk about these things, but give kids tools to recognize mental illness when they see it, to know what to do if they're confronted by something. And we talk about physical health in school. There's no reason we can't talk about mental health.
Yeah. And of course, we very much agree. So thank you for your support on that one. And mm-hmm. we are actually coming to the end of our time now. So we'll start wrapping up here. If people want to find out more about your work and hopefully go listen to your podcast, read your book, where should they go?
They could find it through Googling the podcast. It's called The Domino Effect of Murder. It is sponsored by the Mental Health News Radio Network. And it is going to be in the second season. I'm already recording for that. The book is available on Amazon. It's got a long title. The short title is A Life Divided. And I'm in the works right now. I'm on my way to Detroit within a couple weeks to go do the audiobook version of it. Right now, it's just available in paperback through Amazon.
Brilliant. And as someone with dyslexia, I can assure you I will probably be one of the first people to listen to your audio version. So best of luck with that. All right, we'll wrap up there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. Good luck with your efforts to help the education of the mental health in the schools.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.